I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The digital currency known as Bitcoin was launched in 2009 by someone or someones known as Satoshi Nakamoto. His or her or their identity is still somewhat of a mystery. Bitcoin has no central banking agency. Rather, it functions as a peer-to-peer payment system. And while some are wary about crypto or virtual currency because of the potential for criminal activity, Bitcoin has grown in popularity and in value in the past few years, although it has had its ups and downs. We were curious about Bitcoin, what it is, how it works, and why it matters, which is why we invited two guests to join us in this hour of Radio Times. Tom Standage is the digital editor at The Economist, editor-in-chief of its website, economist.com, and he joins us from the studios of The Economist in London. And Tom Standage, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello, good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Robert McMillan, senior writer for Wired. He joins us from his home. And Robert McMillan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Tom, let me begin with you. Do you have any theories about who you think this Satoshi Nakamoto is?
No, I don't have any sort of inside knowledge on this. There was a suggestion made a few months ago by quite a senior internet figure, actually, who does have connections to Japanese academia, and he said, "I think it's this guy over here." And his theory was almost immediately exposed as very unlikely to be true. So a lot of people have spent a lot of time thinking about this, and it does seem to be unclear. And Satoshi, whoever he, she, or they are, did take part in the discussions around the development of the Bitcoin software and so on. In the early years of the Bitcoin, the original paper describing it appeared in 2008, mm-hmm. and then the first software in 2009, but has gone quiet. So we can't even ask this anonymous figure themselves to give us any clues.
Does it matter, Bob, from your perspective, who Satoshi Nakamoto is?
What? I've avoided that question because so many people have tried to figure out who Satoshi is and failed or appeared to fail. I think it makes the Bitcoin currency more intriguing. But there certainly are people who wonder about putting their faith in something that was created by an anonymous entity. I guess with Bitcoin, though, that's sort of the point, is that it's something that you can put your faith in. You put your faith in the mathematics and not necessarily the person who wrote the code.
I do want to get into some of the nuts and bolts of Bitcoin, but I ran across an interesting comment or quote from a John Matonis, executive director of the Bitcoin Foundation. He's quoted as saying, "Right now in the United States, Bitcoin is mainly considered a get-rich-quick scheme with little financial privacy thrown in, but its larger implications down the road are major disruptions to certain legacy industries." Tom, do you see Bitcoin as a political movement, a financial movement?
Yes, I think there's a lot of truth in that position. Essentially, there are a lot of people who like the idea of Bitcoin and support it essentially for political reasons. So it appeals to essentially to a libertarian crowd. It also appeals to people who think that the government is too involved in the economy and that you shouldn't have things like central banks. So there's quite a, and then of course you have drug dealers who like the idea of being able to use it as well. So there's quite an interesting group of sort of coalition of people who are approve of Bitcoin and would like to see it succeed. But there are an awful lot of different ways you can look at it. Yes, you can think of it as a payments network, or you can think of it as a form of currency. You can also think of it as a commodity or a security. Some people are definitely treating it like that. And some people would say it's a Ponzi scheme. And that, again, goes back to this suspicion about not knowing who the creator is, because the creator does seem to own quite a lot of the first group of Bitcoins that were mined. So some people have said, "Oh, this is very suspicious. Clearly, the whole thing was set up, and when the value gets very high, they'll sell, and this must be why they've done it." And it's very hard to rule that possibility out if you don't know who the creator is.
One of the things that you have written, Bob, and I have some sort of basic questions about Bitcoin, is think of it kind of like PayPal.
Yeah, I mean,
or maybe PayPal meets Napster.
well, the way the way I think of Bitcoin is as a software platform. I mean, it's. Some people there were some congressional hearings in the fall where there was some talk about comparing Bitcoin to the internet. And what I mean by that is, essentially it's software that's shared amongst computers on the internet. And there are all these sort of interesting and clever ways that the software can be extended. It can be used as currency. It can be used as a payment platform. And in and of itself, it's not like PayPal. It's more like sort of the rails that underline PayPal. But there are companies around today that are basically trying to sort of add some of the services and some of the things that, that a PayPal does to Bitcoin. And so you could sort of see Bitcoin as a platform on which you could build a PayPal. You could build a Western Union on top of Bitcoin. You could maybe build a bank. And, so, you know, some of the sort of extreme people in the Bitcoin community feel like you could build a, you know, federal, you know, your own currency on top of Bitcoin.
A currency outside the kind of traditional currency, the fiat
exactly.
currency.
Yeah.
Tom, how would I get a Bitcoin? How would I get Bitcoin?
Well, there are two ways of doing it. The old way was that you got your computer, installed the Bitcoin software on it, and you left your computer to mine Bitcoins. And we're going to have to get into what mining is exactly.
Yes.
And it's a hard thing to explain, but essentially your computer solves some difficult puzzles which have the side effect of ensuring the integrity of the Bitcoin system itself. And there's a sort of lottery, and all of the people whose computers are participating in mining are taking part in this lottery, and every 10 minutes or so one of them gets 25 Bitcoins, which is currently worth, you know, $25,000 or something like that. In the old days there weren't so many people participating, and so you really could turn on your laptop, leave it running for a couple of weeks, and you would get some Bitcoin at the end of it. There are now so many people doing this that your chances of winning the lottery are much, much smaller. They're pretty much nil unless you're, you know, investing in very specialised hardware these days. So the much easier way of doing it is to go to one of the many services online of varying degrees of reputability and simply buy some Bitcoin. And so a good example in the US would be Coinbase. Going back to what you were just saying about PayPal, mm-hmm. In theory, everyone thinks of Bitcoin as something you buy and sell with. The problem is most people are buying and holding. Because the value has been going up, although it's very bumpy, you know, people looking at the value of Bitcoin a year ago and it was sort of about $15, and saying, God, now it's worth $1,000. I should just buy $100 of Bitcoin in the hope that it goes up by a similar factor again. And so there are a lot of people just buying and sitting on this. They're not using it as a currency. They're treating it as an investment. And that's why it's not really working like PayPal. And that's why I'm always very amused when we saw in the run-up to the holiday season, where we see all these companies saying they'll accept Bitcoin for payments. Well, of course they will, because they're hoping that people will give them something that appreciates in value. And meanwhile, the people who've got Bitcoin are saying, I would be mad to pay for my, you know, frankly, anything for a hot dog or web hosting or whatever using Bitcoin, because it could be worth more tomorrow. So at the moment there is a great reluctance to actually use it as a currency. There's much more enthusiasm for sitting
as
on it.
As an investment of some sort. Bob, do we know how much is in circulation?
There are about 12 million Bitcoins in circulation, and Satoshi is thought to possess about 1 million of that 12 million. So that gives you and Satoshi hasn't spent any of his or hers or they their Bitcoin. So that gives you a sense of how many just, you know, one person is sitting on.
Right. And these wild fluctuations in 2013, how should we understand that, Bob?
Well, people are betting on the come. I mean, this is a hot technology. You know, I think people think of Bitcoin almost like a, you know, pre-IPO startup equity investment. You know, and so when I started writing about Bitcoin a year ago, they were trading for $13 each, and I think today it, you know, you can buy a Bitcoin for about $820. So. Yeah. You know, there are definitely a lot of people who just think that this is a, you know, your typical internet startup type story where if you get in early, you can make a lot of money. But it's interesting to me. I mean, the most interesting things about Bitcoin really are not the sort of speculative run up that's been happening with it, but its sort of potential as a software platform and the way it can, you know, make payment, transactions much less expensive, and they're you know, the way it can be extended. But we haven't really, you know, that hasn't really been the narrative that has excited people so far.
Well, you know, Tom, in preparation for the show, I was thinking about the, you know, the financial crisis of what, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and how so much of our financial system is backed up by trust, you know, by belief. And I wonder whether Bitcoin is sort of raises questions about what exactly is fiat money backed up or based on?
Yes, you only have to look at the comment thread spread under any article about Bitcoin, and essentially you've got people, it very quickly devolves into an argument about whether, you know, governments could be trusted, basically. So all currencies involve some measure of consensual hallucination, and essentially you trust the government. If you've got a government with a central bank, and you're trusting them not to devalue your savings by flooding the money markets with essentially by printing new money. Although, of course, central banks everywhere have been flooding markets with money just to keep the economy moving. But the idea is that you're always at risk if you have a fiat currency that the government can inflate away its value. And so a lot of people like Bitcoin for the reason that they think that's not going to happen, because there's no way the number of Bitcoins that can ever exist is fixed, and there is no central authority. That's the whole appeal of it. So there is very much this idea that Bitcoin is a critique of the way, and it's very interesting that it appears, you know, just as the financial crisis is getting going, yes, that it's a critique of the way that monetary policy operates conventionally. But I think what's much more interesting is that it's actually, you know, what's most fascinating about it for me is that it is a demonstration that you can have a currency, although it doesn't need to be working terribly well as a currency, but anyway, it's at least a proof of concept. You can have a currency without a central bank, and that's what's so clever about it, because previous electronic money systems use cryptography so that I can securely send money to you, say, but there's nothing to stop me sending it to Bob as well, because it's digital, so I can copy it. And so you've got this problem, a classical problem called the double spending problem. You have to stop people with digital currencies spending the same money twice. The usual way to do that is you have a central authority which keeps track of what everyone's doing and makes sure that you don't spend it twice. And what's so brilliant about Bitcoin is that it manages to do this without a central authority. It has a distributed means of preventing double spending, which is how we get back to the blockchain and the mining and so on. But that's really the innovation. It shows, just like Skype showed, you could have a telephone network without central servers, although cough cough, it now actually has central servers. And BitTorrent showed that you could distribute media without a central, you know, broadcast network. Bitcoin suggests that you could do the same with money.
Well, Bob, about a minute before our first break here, but Bitcoin is legal, correct?
Bitcoin is legal, yeah, but buying and selling Bitcoin sometimes can put you into gray areas of the law. I just did a story today about how a 1862 U.S. law called the Stamp Postage Act could potentially be used to incarcerate people who spend less than a dollar on Bitcoin. The problem is that, you know, the financial institutions in financial regulations in the United States were not really created with Bitcoin in mind, and so there are all these gray areas where if you basically try to interact with the financial system, you can sometimes get yourself in trouble. The problem that's facing a lot of Bitcoin businesses right now is that they are essentially involved in the business of money transmission, and that's a highly regulated business in the United States. The United States government wants to know if people are moving money, you know, whether they're laundering money and whether they're providing terrorists with aid. So there's just a whole bunch of regulations that cover people who move money around, but some rather small businesses are engaged in basically money transmission in the United States, and they sort of been doing this and then suddenly found themselves in the crosshairs of the federal government because they've been running afoul of federal regulations.
We are talking about Bitcoin virtual currency. That's Robert McMillan, senior writer for Wired. Also with us, Tom Standage. He's the digital editor for The Economist and editor-in-chief of their website, economist.com. Questions, comments, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students are given individual attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed. A character development program founded on respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance is woven into day-to-day school life. January open houses are this Sunday, the 12th at 2 p.m. and Tuesday, the 28th at 9 a.m. More at chapinschool.org.
Few reporters know Washington like NPR's Cokie Roberts. Hi, I'm Dave Davies, inviting you to join me for a timely and in-depth discussion I'll be hosting with Cokie at the Merriam Theater Thursday, January 23rd. Call 1-888-345-9499 and make a $10 a month sustaining membership gift to WHYY. We'll send you two tickets to this event as our way of saying thanks. Again, that's 1-888-345-9499 to make your sustaining contribution and reserve your seats now. Thanks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Next time on Here and Now, in 2014, writer Adam Gopnik is thinking a lot about 1914, particularly the disasters. World War I and the Titanic had just gone down. But why do we forget about the good things that happened a century ago? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohen, talking about Bitcoin, virtual currency, what it is, how it works, and why it matters. Again, Tom Standage and Bob McMillan, our guests. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Motz-Cohen. Tom, going back to you, I would also think, and there are certainly stories about this, that Bitcoin would be great for criminal activity.
Yes. So the most famous example of this is the use of Bitcoin for transactions on Silk Road, right, which is a sort of dark Amazon buried in the deep internet. And you have to use special software to be able to access this corner of the internet at all. It was shut down at the end of last year by federal investigators, although it's popped up again. It's, you know, websites are very hard to shut down. So that's a sort of, you know, famous example of the kind of thing you might want to use Bitcoin for, to buy drugs, most famously. Surprisingly, though, as academics dig into Bitcoin more and more, they're showing that although it's, you know, widely believed to be anonymous, it isn't actually. The way that the Bitcoin ledger works and the way that you prevent this double spending problem is that there's actually a public record of every single transaction. So you can see that, you know, where the money's flowing around, and there's a lot of very interesting work being done analysing it. You don't obviously know exactly who is who, but when you take money in and out of the system, then it becomes possible in some cases to trace that. And so the idea that this is a sort of perfectly anonymous cryptocurrency is actually not the case. And in fact, this has inspired other people to come up with new offshoots of Bitcoin inspired by it, called a non-coin and zero coin, which are in fact meant to be completely anonymous. Wow. And so in theory, those ought to appeal an awful lot more to the criminal users of Bitcoin. But this is a sort of classic thing with the new technology that people focus on just the bad things about it, and there are some interesting things. I'm just in the process of booking my summer holiday in Italy, for example. Here I am in London. That means I have to make this bank transfer to Italy, and it's a massive pain, and I have to do it every year, and I actually have to go to the bank and fill in a form, and it's about the only time I ever go to the bank. To be able to just zip that money across to people in Italy would be wonderful, but at the moment I can't do it. So the prospect of being able to send money straight from one computer to another as easily as I can send a text or a photograph or a document is obviously hugely appealing, and that's one of the possibilities that something like Bitcoin raises.
Well, and just even going back to this Silk Road, and was shut down, I guess, by the feds in this country, Bob, was this a significant case and an important way to understand at least, I guess, the dark side of Bitcoin?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the Silk Road definitely helped build build Bitcoin. I mean, that was the currency used on the Silk Road, and the Bitcoin sort of rose in tandem alongside the Silk Road. So it was maybe, I think you could argue it was the first sort of killer app of Bitcoin.
Right.
And when the Silk Road was shut down this fall, people thought instantly that was going to be bad news for Bitcoin. Suddenly all these people who were using Bitcoin weren't going to be able to use it anymore. And surprisingly, the takedown at the Silk Road coincided with the massive run-up. Bitcoin was trading at, I think, around $200 at the time the Silk Road was shut down. It dropped instantly, and now it's quadrupled in value since then. So in a weird way, it seemed like the publicity around the Silk Road fueled this speculative, you know, interest in Bitcoin. It sort of was like a marketing coup for it in a weird way.
We got a press release from Philadelphia Brewing Company just this morning saying that they were going to use Bitcoin for retail and wholesale purchases. I'll go back to you, Bob. Are you seeing in this country companies, small companies, thinking about or using Bitcoin?
Well, you have Overstock talking about using it, Zynga talking about using it. Bitcoin makes a lot of sense for retailers. It's because they're very low fees to use it, for one thing, and retailers are often, the way the financial system, the way credit cards work right now, retailers often find themselves on the hook if there's a disputed transaction. They often pay fees that seem excessive to them. So I think that as more and more retailers start adopting it, I think there'll be a sense that, you know, we can save some money and some hassles using Bitcoin. The trick is, as Tom mentioned, you know, there may not be a lot of incentive for people who have a currency that's like quadrupling every, you know, 4 months to actually spend that.
Right.
But you know, that could fade away as you know, as the currency matures.
Well, Tom, I noticed a lot of people noticed Richard Branson saying that he would accept Bitcoin as a payment for a trip on Virgin Galactic into outer space. I think it was a flight attendant who said she was going to pay with Bitcoin. Was that a publicity stunt, or does that tell us something about how these, you know, billionaires are thinking about Bitcoin?
Well, Richard Branson hasn't got to where he is today by, turning
being
a blind
shy,
eye,
right?
Yes, to a possible publicity stunt. He's an absolute, you know, genius at that sort of thing. So yes, this has got publicity stunt written all over it. Yes, everyone piling into this and saying, we will accept Bitcoins. I mean, firstly, of course you want to accept Bitcoins if you can, if they're appreciating. And secondly, it doesn't do any harm to associate yourself with this. So it's a bit like in, you know, the 1990s when everyone said, oh, we're going to have a website. And that was like, oh, that's really cool. So, you know, this company's got a website now. That means they're, you know, they're really looking to the future. So, yeah, this sounds very, very familiar to me. And I think in practice, actually using Bitcoin to buy things is still much too hard. You know, there are restrictions on, you know, you may have a smartphone where you're not allowed to use Bitcoin apps on it. It can take a while to get money in and out of the system. A friend of mine here has some Bitcoin, in fact, which he's been trying to spend, and he can't really find anything to spend it on. There's almost no one that will take it. So it's actually still quite difficult. So theoretically, this is great because I zap money from my computer to yours. In practice, what I'll really be doing is trying to use a wallet service. Getting money in and out of a wallet service is not instant, these sorts of frictions are still, you know, very much holding up the adoption of Bitcoin as an actual currency, which is why it continues to be seen as a money laundering device or an investment.
Bob, it seems like a lot of work, sort of like 3D printing, making chocolate. You know? I mean, it's interesting and innovative in many ways, but it just, I guess, to the regular person, and I consider myself a regular person in, you know, that uses fiat currency, it seems like a lot of work to use Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I when I started writing about Bitcoin, I basically tried to acquire it in any way I could, and as Tom points out, it was pretty clumsy. I mean, there was a lot of, I would go to Bitcoin meetups and it was almost like a drug deal. You know, I'd give somebody $20 and then they'd sort of fiddle with their smartphone for a while, and I'd have to email them a complicated address and they'd put that in, and you know, finally I get my Bitcoins. You have to wait like 10 minutes for the network to confirm the transaction. So there's this kind of like awkward waiting period where you're like, is the money there? Is the money there? And then finally it comes through. But, you know, there's some smart people trying to address this. In the last year, there's this company in the United States called Coinbase that's made it pretty easy to sort of buy into Bitcoin. You kind of go to their website and you enter your bank account and link that up, and they basically just do, you know, they move the money from your bank account into an exchange and buy your Bitcoins and then give you the Bitcoins right away. So I think it's getting easier, but, you know, in my experience, it's always, it's harder than you might expect to both trade for Bitcoins and mining them as well. I've done that too, and that was a bit of a challenge.
But do you, Tom, and then I do want to get to our callers, I mean, do you see Bitcoin and virtual currency, cryptocurrency, as, you know, a 21st century way of thinking about money and finances and transactions?
Yes, I do. I just don't think Bitcoin is necessarily the example that will end up prevailing. So I think you mentioned Napster earlier on. I think that's quite a good analogy. Technically, it's not such a good analogy because Napster's flaw was it did have central servers, which is why it got shut down. Bitcoin doesn't. But ultimately, Napster, it was significant because it proved that there was demand for something. The idea that we now call the celestial jukebox, that you can just call up music. Of course, that's what I can now do with Spotify, and it's legal and I pay for it, and that's great. So I think Bitcoin could have a similar role, which is that it opens people's eyes up to these possibilities, but it's then superseded by technically superior ways of doing things. The other great irony here is that Bitcoin is being made easy to use by trusted companies showing up and saying, we will handle all the hard stuff for you. And that means that those companies, such as Coinbase, start to become very powerful in the Bitcoin ecosystem. And if I want to send you money and we're both Coinbase users, that Coinbase is actually just going to move it between our accounts. And the Bitcoin network's not going to get touched at all. And that's starting to look an awful lot like the conventional banking system. So I think this is, we're probably going to end up just as Spotify ended up being somewhat peer-to-peer, but somewhat centralized, but also legal, but also inspired by Napster. That's the kind of future I think we're going to see with Bitcoin.
Is that the future you see, Bob?
Well, I don't buy the Napster analogy. I mean, I think I maybe would have, maybe a year ago that might have worked, but I mean, just watching what happened in Congress, you know, at these congressional hearings in the fall, I mean, there's clearly a desire and a willingness of the U.S. government and regulators to kind of make Bitcoin work. I think there's a sense here in the United States that, you know, it would be sort of uncool to quash this like futuristic, you know, cryptocurrency technology. People in Washington don't want to. It's just not cool to seem unfriendly to new technology. So, and plus the foundation that sort of leads the development of Bitcoin has been pretty savvy in lobbying Washington to date. So, I feel like, you know, Napster started kind of fundamentally in opposition to these entrenched interests, where Bitcoin has been, in a way, a little bit more subtle, even though there is this stuff with the Silk Road. There's been a pretty successful Washington lobbying effort. So it may well be, you know, that the history of technology is full of, you know, great ideas that were then, you know, that failed and then were implemented by other companies. But I'm not quite as down on it as Tom.
Well, apparently, Ben Bernanke's not so down on it as well. He's quoted as saying that, you know, the Bitcoin may hold some long-term promise.
That's not what he said. He said that cryptocurrencies might do. So this
okay.
is my point. So
I gotcha.
we are eliding Bitcoin with all cryptocurrencies. And I'm saying it's the same. So the idea that you get a celestial jukebox of music delivered over the internet using peer-to-peer networking technology, and Spotify delivers about two-thirds of its music using peer-to-peer from other Spotify users, clearly peer-to-peer music had some legs. You just had to find a way to make it easy for people to use and legal. Now, Bitcoin is not having a problem with the legal part of it, but what the Senate committee last year endorsed was the idea of cryptocurrency. It was not Bitcoin in particular. So, yeah,
fair
enough. Something about which reasonable people could reasonably disagree. But I think that's the point. Bernanke was saying there's a there, but that's not the same as everyone should buy Bitcoin.
No, I appreciate you saying that. And that's Tom Standage, digital editor for The Economist, editor-in-chief of its website, economist.com. Robert McMillan, Bob McMillan, senior writer with Wired. We are talking about Bitcoin, virtual currency, cryptocurrency, whatever you want to call it. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We got a tweet, actually, from Street Glitter Gallery. We accept Bitcoin at Street Glitter Gallery in Fishtown. We love it. So obviously a very small company here in Philadelphia, and they like Bitcoin. Let me see what Sue from Bethlehem has to say. Sue, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
For Christmas, for my 22-year-old son, I wanted to be the cool mom and give him $50 worth of Bitcoins. But my family and my friends are very skeptical, so I wanted to do it in cash. I found a website, Buy Bitcoins with Cash, texted the seller, the nearby seller, never responded. Tried it again after Christmas, never responded. So now I see that it says he's currently on vacation or is out of Bitcoins. I want to know, what is the safest way to buy Bitcoins? I don't want to give my banking account number to somebody for a virtual currency. So any suggestions on the safest way to buy Bitcoins?
Sure, Sue. And Bob, can I toss that first to you?
Yeah, I've done it. There's a website called you have to, what you're looking at is going face-to-face. I mean, if you don't want to give up your information, you go to a website called localbitcoins.com, and there you can arrange to meet somebody. I've met people in coffee shops, and, you know, just you hand them some cash, and they give them an address to pay to, and then they'll pay you. it's sort of a, it's kind of a weird thing, but
it is.
You know, it really comes back to this idea that, you know, if you want to transact over the internet, the government wants to know who's moving the money around. So there, you know, another thing you could do is you could try and find a Bitcoin meetup. There are often these local Bitcoin enthusiast groups that have meetups, you know, every week or something like that. And you can just go there, and that's sort of a more, you know, a public. There are lots of people around, and they all want to help you. There's sort of this enthusiast crowd, so they'll you know, that's, I bought Bitcoins that way too, and it's kind of a fun and pleasant experience. So, yeah, I'd probably recommend try and find a local meetup first, and if that doesn't work, go to localbitcoins.com.
Good luck, Sue. And Tom, that's so interesting that here we are talking about cryptocurrency, but the safest and best way to do it is to have a transaction is person-to-person or face-to-face.
Yeah, and I think that says a lot about the current maturity of this technology. So I'm sure that something like this is going to happen in the long run. But this does look like an early iteration that isn't ready for prime time. And maybe like the internet, it will go from being an experiment that looks a bit ropey. I mean, the internet crashed the first time anyone tried to do anything on it after two characters, to becoming a utility. But I'm inclined to think that a sort of improved, sleeker design that is actually got trusted companies behind it is more likely to prevail.
Let me see what Derek from Kensington has to say. Derek, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Bitcoin has changed my life. I'm a 24-year-old former haberdasher, and I now am able to run a podcast run purely off of Bitcoin donations. All I have to do is put a QR code on my website, and people who enjoy listening are able to send me donations, and now I have an entirely new lifestyle. I can spend my Bitcoins at Whole Foods and get groceries, and I can convert them to food using other ways, like you just mentioned, local Bitcoin, or coinmap.org is another great one where businesses can list that they accept Bitcoins, and then I can know that and then go to them.
And why is that better than fiat currency, Derek?
Well, formerly I was working for the man, and I had a real problem with chucking over about 10% of my salary to pay for things that I don't support, like building bombs and blowing up brown people overseas. With Bitcoin, that can't happen. My money is only sent when I send it. It can't be taken from my account by the tax man.
So you don't pay taxes?
Well, it's not taken automatically. It's a big difference.
Well, Derek, let me give Bob McMillan a chance to respond. And Bob, since you've done a lot of research here in the States, is this a familiar sounding story to you?
Well, you know, how do you start a currency? You know, if you go back to the very early days of Bitcoin, this sort of gifting culture was integral to it. I mean, I was talking to one of the lead Bitcoin developers a couple of weeks ago, and I said, well, now that you're a multimillionaire because you were involved in Bitcoin early on, what are you doing with all that money? And he said that he gave away all of his Bitcoins. And I think that's kind of a common story, and that's sort of a common thing you see in the Bitcoin culture, you know, where the currency, in order to get traction, people literally gave away, you know, fortunes to sort of as a way of enticing other people to becoming interested in it. And that sort of, from Derek's story, that sort of seems like a manifestation of this sort of gift giving culture, which is kind of part of the old school Bitcoin community. I'm not sure if it'll be around forever, but it's sort of an interesting aspect of the Bitcoin world. I hear that kind of thing a lot.
Derek, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moscoane. We're talking about virtual currency, Bitcoin. Tom Standage and Robert McMillan, our guests. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next time on The Pulse, it seems like two old friends getting together. But one woman is an oncology nurse, the other is dying.
I have been fighting cancer for 5 years, and it has been an uphill battle.
Joanna Little is done fighting, but not done living.
Next Friday, I'm taking my oldest back to college.
Changing end-of-life care.
How have you been?
Did she tell you I'm the Energizer Bunny now?
That's on the Pulse, Friday morning at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Russia's anti-gay laws. We talk with Russian journalist Masha Gessen, who just emigrated to New York with her partner and their children to escape those laws. We'll also talk about Pussy Riot, the subject of Gessen's new book. She just interviewed the two members who were recently released from prison as part of Putin's pre-Olympics amnesty. Join us. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The bad of nukes.
A lifetime of working in a nuclear power plant has given me a healthy green glow.
And the good of nukes.
We're concerned about making sure that we do have the standards in place to address the safety needs of the public.
Which is more entertaining. A good guy engineer who makes nuclear power safe. His name is not Mr. Burns. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Any questions or comments about Bitcoin, virtual currency, cryptocurrency, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me go back to you, Tom, and just picking up on what Derek said about working for the man, and now he basically, you know, lives in the world of Bitcoin. I'm curious about people like Derek who are attracted to this kind of currency, and you wrote about Gulch in Chile, hard thing to say.
Yes, this is the idea that you set up a new community that's, you know, escapes from the rest of the world and can make its own rules and doesn't have to pay taxes and can use its own, doesn't have to use a fiat currency that is dependent on, you know, on a bank. So and isn't dependent on a central bank and a government that might do stupid things. You get these informal currencies, you know, like cigarettes that are used in prisons and so on. And in this case, if you're setting up a utopian community somewhere or a commune, you can say, hey, let's use Bitcoin. So we'll see how that works out. But yes, this is very much of a piece with that sort of, I suppose you could say, survivalist or extreme libertarian position that people should not be dependent on government at all, and government should not be meddling in people's lives.
And Bob, there's a big strain of that in this country.
Sure, there is. I mean, some people would argue that Bitcoin really took off in New Hampshire with the Free State Movement, and you know, there are definitely some early advocates there. I should note that, you know, the IRS has talked about Bitcoin, and they consider money you make in Bitcoin to be fully taxable.
Ah, so they want to find out what Derek is doing. I guess.
The IRS always wants to know about money, yeah.
let me see what Brian from Yardley has to say. Brian, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I'm wondering, what is the difference between Bitcoins today and the old system of bartering that happened in one of the past recessions that we had in the early 1980s in New York? Many small businesses and even some larger big companies would barter their services, and they would keep track with a point system. And so we didn't barter one to one, but we would barter and put the points into a pool, and then we could pull from those points and go get a different service.
And it worked, Brian?
I'm sorry.
It worked
for a while until the recession went away.
Right. Well, that's an interesting comment. And Tom, what do you think about that?
Well, it's interesting because that system involved a pool that had to have a central administrator. So one obvious difference is that Bitcoin doesn't have somebody making sure that doesn't have a central organization making sure that everyone is playing fair. Instead, that is very, very cleverly distributed across the Bitcoin network. So that's one difference. And so if you were worried about getting involved in a system like this because you didn't trust the people who are running the central system, whether they're bankers or the people running a barter point system, then Bitcoin would certainly appeal to you more. On the other hand, the big difference in the other direction is that when you have your barter system and you have points, the value of those points does not fluctuate enormously against other goods. So that is rather a problem if you're trying to use Bitcoin for day-to-day things, that it's very hard to kind of figure out what the appropriate rate ought to be.
Bob, you're out there, and I assume you're out there in Silicon Valley. I'm assuming that's, ground zero for virtual currency in this country?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's sort of a rivalry between Silicon Valley and New York. You know, all the tech geeks who like the software here in Silicon Valley but all the financial types who are interested in the, you know, market mechanics are from New York. So those, I would say those are the two hubs, and then you've got the sort of libertarian contingent, you know, that's sort of heavily representing New Hampshire as well. Those are sort of maybe the three places that are the center here.
Tom, do you think, and we sort of touched on this earlier, but do you think that the kind of cryptocurrency that we've been talking about, do you think that is a threat to fiat currency?
Well, actually, governments can sort of decide, because they can decide whether or not they will accept tax payments in anything other than their own currency. And that's up to them to decide. Interestingly, the German government has decided that Bitcoin is a unit of account, which means it does consider it a form of thing that you can settle accounts in. But we have had lots of central bankers lately making noises, most recently the ECB. And I think we had another central banker this morning saying that the Bundesbank has just said that they're very worried about the volatility of it. And so ultimately, if they say, look, we're not going to accept taxes in Bitcoin any more than we're not going to accept them, you know, paid in cowrie shells, then they can say, we are going to force you to convert your Bitcoin into our fiat currency in order to pay your taxes. Otherwise, we're not going to take it seriously.
And how does China look at this, Bob?
How does China look at this?
Yeah.
Well, you know, China has not outlawed Bitcoin, but over the past month there have been some steps taken that have made it very difficult to interact, to sort of acquire and sell bitcoins. If you talk to people in China, they'll say, we can still buy and sell bitcoins, you know, just like we could a while back. And then they sort of feel that the sort of reported crackdown by the Chinese government is overstated. But it's China has been really moving the value of Bitcoin a lot. There's been an intense amount of interest in trading there from people who are looking for, you know, other places to put their assets. I would say that the Chinese government is concerned that it may be, you know, involved with Bitcoin may just be this dangerous speculative bubble, and it feels to me, just from people I've spoken with in China, that the Bitcoin companies there have sort of somewhat reassured the government, and so things are kind of moving forward. But you know, it could be there. You know, it could be cracked down on even more any day.
We got a tweet from Amricia. How does it compare to the money exchange on Second Life? They call it Linden dollars. Tom, have you looked at that?
Yes, actually, I was just reading this morning about Lily Allen, who is a British pop singer, and she was asked to do a gig in Second Life a few years ago, and they offered to pay her in some, I think it was 100,000 Bitcoin was what they offered her, and she just thought this was mad to, you know, and of course now she's kicking herself because that would be worth a ridiculous amount of money. So, but it's interesting that they offered to pay her in Bitcoin and not in Linden dollars. But yes, if you look at the, there's a very big and interesting literature, at least I think it's interesting, about the use of in-game currencies and the various attempts to exchange those for real items or for real money. So famously, gold farming in games like World of Warcraft, or the ability to buy, you know, upgrades to your weapons or your armor with real money. And different gaming worlds have taken different views on that. And some of them have even hired chief economists, because they are essentially running giant virtual economies.
Wow.
And just as, you know, governments don't want their national economies to get out of control, the same is true of gaming economy. So this also connects to that whole debate as well, which I think is very interesting.
Bob, you wrote about a Bitcoin ATM that's opened in Vancouver in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. That's not an option here in the United States right now, but it's this machine. You walk up to it, you put a $20 bill inside it. It takes a measurement of your hand to sort of comply with the Canadian regulations. They don't want you trading too much Bitcoin in within a 24-hour period, so it sort of figures out who you are, and then it spits out a little ticket, or it can also just scan your smartphone, and it delivers you Bitcoin within 10 minutes.
Oh.
Kind of a neat device.
Let me see what looks like Dan from Chestnut Hill has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi.
Hi there.
From what I understand of currencies and the history, is that we got off the gold standard and established the Federal Reserve because stability was so integral to a workable currency. And so with Bitcoin, I don't really think the advantages of portability and all that will amount to much if they can't establish some degree of stability for commerce. So I'm wondering if the experts think that can be done, and if so, how?
It's a great question, Dan. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Tom, you want to take that first?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting that people who think that having central banks try and look after the stability of the economy is a good thing will look at Bitcoin and go, this is a bit terrible. You've got no central bank and it's incredibly volatile. But the fans of Bitcoin, of course, think that the lack of a central bank is a feature, not a bug. I think the real question comes down to when will the price of Bitcoin stabilize, if ever. If it will not be taken seriously as a currency if its value is going to fluctuate as wildly as it has done. And it's only really when it gets actually used as a currency that people will stop thinking of it as an investment instead, and it will then become stable, and we can actually make some judgments about it, about its efficacy as a currency.
Do you think that'll ever happen, Bob?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Tom, and that is the big question. You know, right now, it's still early days for merchants. There aren't enough people accepting it, and the volatility. I mean, the volatility is sort of dealt with to a certain extent. There are these companies that, you know, if you're a merchant and you're accepting Bitcoin, they'll convert your Bitcoin to U.S. dollars at a predictable rate, and so you're not suddenly involved in currency, you know, cryptocurrency speculation just because you're accepting Bitcoin. So that's moved over a little bit, but there just aren't enough people accepting it right now. So that needs to happen for all these other things to sort of settle.
Let me see what David from looks like Elkins Park has to say. And David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm an economist, and quite honestly, I'm very, very distressed that this is going forward. The first thing to realize is the changing value of Bitcoin is equivalent to huge inflation and huge deflation. A first principle of a conservative position is that the value of money must be reasonably stable. Now, I really think we have to put this in context, and I don't want to take up other people's time, so I'll be very quick here.
That'd be good.
We have to first of all recognize that this is just one more manifestation of casino capitalism in the worst sense, and quite honestly, it could lead, I believe, to a real disaster. And I think it's almost science fiction that I'm hearing. So let me go off the air.
No, I appreciate it. Again, interesting comments. Bob, let me toss that first to you.
That's why we're interested in it, because it is almost
exactly
science fiction. I mean, it's amazing that it's gotten as far as it has. And I feel like the only way, it's very difficult to understand Bitcoin, because it's you need to be an economist and you need to understand technology simultaneously and see where they're, and international finance, and see where all these threads are meeting up. And I don't feel like I have a handle on that. You know, I've been writing about it for a year. It's like nobody knows what's going to happen here.
Well, and it's interesting he uses the word casino capitalism, Tom, and we've been talking about the enormous fluctuations, the lack of stability with something like Bitcoin. Do you see it as casino capitalism?
Well, casino capitalism is usually a term that is used to denounce the behaviors of investment banks that take other people's money and gamble with it. Right. And, you know, they share in the upside, but when it all goes wrong, they turn to the government and go, oh, no, help. And that's not what's happening with Bitcoin. No one is forcing me to use Bitcoin. And so I take the point that, you know, if the entire economy started to work on Bitcoin and it was this volatile, that would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. But no one is making anyone do this. The other thing I'd say on the science fiction is that there's a science fiction writer called Charlie Stross who wrote a book called Neptune's Children. I think it came out last year, which I read. And it's fantastic because it thinks about, and this is something Paul Krugman's talked about as well, how you would do interstellar commerce and how you would handle things like long-term volatility and exchange rates. But what Charles Stross does is he imagines a future where interstellar commerce is essentially done using a Bitcoin-like system, and the plot hinges on the uncertainty that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. So I recommend that to anyone who likes science fiction and economics and technology.
I don't even know how to think about that. let me see what Richard from looks like Yardley has to say. Richard, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, everybody.
Hi there.
In the long term, if cryptocurrencies become widely acceptable, what impact would that have on the price of gold, or how would that interact with gold? Could it be a substitute for gold, for example?
Tom, do you want to take that first?
Well, the gold price has been going down. So I'm not sure that there's a... I mean, I think the Bitcoin price has been going up because you can use it to do things like you can stash money overseas if you're Chinese using Bitcoin in a way that you can't so easily with gold. So I don't know whether the fall of the price of gold is because... well, it's partly going to be because people are more optimistic about the future. So generally, you know, when people are scared, the gold price goes up. But I don't know what Bob thinks about the extent to which Bitcoin is substituting for some of the speculative activity in gold. What do you think, Bob, about the relationship between Bitcoin bugs and gold bugs?
Yeah, what do you think?
I read a gold advocate just trashing Bitcoin the other day. It was really interesting. I mean, I think that community of people really liked the idea of Bitcoin because it sort of embodied some of the ideas that, you know, the sort of independence of the Fed ideas that were popular there. You got to keep in mind that the market cap of Bitcoin, you know, the value of all these Bitcoins is somewhere in the neighborhood of $10 billion, which is really not very much compared to things like gold or, you know, the currency of the United States. So right now, it just seems like it's sort of a non-issue to me.
And we have a final email question from Ian. What makes cryptocurrencies fluctuate? And there's probably a long answer to that, but Tom, we have about a minute left.
Basically, when politicians are nice about them, like Ben Bernanke was, then people go, woo! And then when politicians go, no, this is bad, then they tend to... So they are very susceptible to changing opinions from politicians, which is, I think, a big reason for the volatility.
How about media coverage?
That doesn't hurt. I mean, I think that tends to... I think the optimists about technology will always, you know, see the good things, and then the... You get this with all technology. So, and I think the earlier point that Bob made about Silk Road, that made a big deal as well. So when Bitcoin is in the news, then that makes the skeptics even less inclined to use it, but the people who are thinking about it more inclined to get involved.
Do you think, Bob, there's any explanation for why all our callers, as far as I can understand, or certainly are people calling into the show or sending us email or tweets, were men?
Are men? no, I don't know. I mean, this is sort of a bigger question, really.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we had one woman who was trying to buy Bitcoin for herself.
That's true.
Yeah.
Equal opportunities for Bitcoin.
Fair enough. Well, I really appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. I feel like I learned a lot. I understand much more what Bitcoin, what cryptocurrency is all about. Tom Stanage, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And he's the digital editor at The Economist, editor-in-chief of their website, economist.com. And Robert McMillan, thank you very much as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Senior writer with Wired. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. It's our homepage there. And you can leave a comment, and you can also send us an email. You can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.